All right, well, let's get started with just a little bit of background. For folks who, for some reason, have managed to live in this world without having heard of Masoud Ayoub, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Basically, 68 years old at this time, shooter since age 4, handgun shooter since age 9, carrier since age 12, starting at my dad's jewelry store, working there part-time. Researched it ever since I was a kid, got into it seriously when I started carrying in my dad's store, and real seriously a decade later when I became a part-time police officer. Wound up becoming department firearms instructor at an early age. That led me on an odyssey to a lot of different training schools that I've pretty much kept up over the decades.
And you say your dad had a... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You said your dad had a store? Was it a gun store?
A jewelry store,
I'm sorry. Yeah. Gotcha. Okay, now I think you'd probably agree that teaching is an entirely different art form than shooting. So what? So talk a little bit about that.
One thing they have in common is, like all communications, it's, you know, the public general, in both cases, the public generally thinks it's a two-step process of send and receive.
Uh-huh.
And both shooting and communication are a three-step process: send, receive, and confirm receipt of message.
Interesting.
Repeat if necessary.
At what point did you realize that you were interested in the teaching side, being a trainer as opposed to just a practitioner?
When I was asked to do it at age 23, and I didn't really think I'd be good at it, but it turned out to work well for me and the students. I got into it more. And, if somebody had asked me when I was in high school, what are the last two professions you'd ever want to be stuck with? I would have told him, being a cop because everybody hates you, and being a teacher because it's boring as hell and nobody listens to you. And turned out otherwise.
That's funny. Okay, so tell me about some of the early training experiences that you can recall, either as an early instructor or with your own instructors as a student, that have had the most lasting impact on you.
Well, basically, it was clear early on when I started in the early 70s that tradition had stagnated for a very long time. We were still supposed to be shooting below eye level, even at 7 yards. The barricade techniques we were taught were, shall we say, less than optimal. People were telling us, well, gee, you can't see your gun sight, so don't even try, even though, you know, history had long since shown otherwise. I gathered and still do a debriefing of every gunfight survivor I could find who was willing to talk. And certain patterns emerged. The people who aimed hit, the people who didn't, by and large. And basically, the people who were into it were much more likely to survive. And particularly the competitive shooters had an extraordinary survival rate.
Interesting.
And basically, I can only conclude where that comes from is, for them, shooting the gun under pressure had become the norm. And it was something they could do successfully on autopilot. And it left their cognitive mind free to make the decision, do I have to shoot this guy? What's the safest angle for me to take? Where's the best cover, et cetera? So I've long been an advocate of competitive shooting as not training per se, but as an adjunct to training, part of the skill testing element of training.
So that's one of the things that's often the subject of debate nowadays, and I wonder if you could speak more to that through this lens. One of the things that I think Tom wants to accomplish with this work is to provide a roadmap for folks who are new to this art, who are new shooters, who don't have the luxury of having lived through the evolution of what we do from the 70s, the way you and Tom have, and who may not fully appreciate why things have changed in the ways that they have. So when you mentioned competition, I mean, I was looking through some of these old books, and even Cooper's book, and handgunning and a couple of others that are published in the 60s, and just looking at some of the illustrations and thinking to myself, my goodness, you know, the whole stand at the extreme angle and one hand on your hip and fire with one hand and all of that, everything has changed so much. So can you talk a little bit about that and what the impetus is in many cases for those changes?
Sure. Well, going first, if you go back to the 19th century, Rex Applegate found some old documentation of interviews and both and writings by James Butler Hickok, Wild Bill Hickok. Hickok had spoken of shooting only as fast as you could hit, of practicing daily, while he was seen by some as an advocate of point shooting. The man shot, clearly shot with a gun at eye level. And one of his most famous gunfights used a supported hold. Witnesses varied whether he was holding his Navy Colt with two hands or whether he had raised an elbow forward like a forward elbow strike and had braced the gun on the elbow. But at 75 yards, he fired one shot, struck his opponent, Dave Tutt, in the heart, mortally wounded the guy where he stood and ended the gunfight. 1920s, a Hollywood scriptwriter named Stuart Lake found out Wyatt Earp was still alive and living up in the Bay Area. And while Earp had been notoriously reticent his whole life about talking about, you know, the tombstone, the whole tombstone saga, he caught him at just the right time. Shortly before, one of Earp's old antagonists, Billy Breckenridge, had written a book about the tombstone years called Hell Dorado, and he just excoriated Earp and his brothers as pimps, thieves, and murderers. And here's Earp approaching the end of his life and knowing it, absolutely seething. And along comes the scriptwriter who catches him at just the right time and says, hey, I'd like to tell your side of things. The book came out after Earp's death. The title was Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal. And it becomes pretty clear, Lake early on lost perspective as a biographer and basically became a starstruck fan and, you know, started the kind of the whole cult of Wyatt Earp, a superhero. But reading between the lines, I'd have to go back and see the book, but I want to say it's chapter two, Earp's discussion of the mind of the gunfighter. He told Lake that every man he ever shot, he had brought the gun to eye level, long gun or handgun, had carefully aligned the front, the foresight with the back sight, apparently is what they called front and rear sights in the 19th century, and had been careful to squeeze, not jerk the trigger. And he takes a couple of very long sentences, damn near a paragraph, to say, take your time quick. Earp, if you put it all together, may have killed as many as 10 men in some pretty hairy gunfights and never lost a drop of blood to a bullet himself. If you look back historically, Earp denied it, but there's strong historical evidence to believe he wore a concealed steel vest that probably saved his life once or twice over. Always made a point of carrying two guns. On horseback or in a horse and buggy, would have carbine and shotgun. And basically, he was living what we teach our cops today in the year 2016. And if you go back, he shot the informal matches in the cow towns like Dodge City. And there's indications that he apparently shot informal matches even when he was at Tombstone. He had been a buffalo hunter and used a shotgun with slugs instead of a Sharps, and simply managed to crawl up close enough to the buffalo herd to kill him with a pumpkin ball out of a 12-gauge. So there were lots of parallels there with what we're teaching today in terms of officer survival. Now, he gets into the, let's say the 20s and the 30s. Jelly Bryce may well have been the greatest gunfighter of the time. Certainly from the Oklahoma side and the FBI side. And he started his career in law enforcement when the local chief of police saw him win a pistol match. Frank Hamer, another of the great gunfighters of the period, throughout his life put on exhibition shoots. And essentially, we're talking the same thing, shooting under pressure. There's 20 people watching you, maybe 100 people watching you to see if you can hit that thing you just threw up in the air when you're shooting at it with your pistol. So for all these men, they had made shooting under stress the norm, something they did regularly, and there was definitely the carrot and stick thing going on then. Now you look at going to mid-20th century, 60s, early 70s, New York City Stanko Squad. The top guns on that squad, the two of them, were Bill Allard and Jim Cirillo. Both of them were competitive shooters. Both of them were avid gun hobbyists and reloaders. Both of them shot matches on the weekends whenever they could. Allard became national champion, shooting for the National Guard in Bullseye. And Cirillo set or tied national records shooting PPC. Going to the 70s and the 80s, Kerry Heil, H-I-L-E, from, and I'm trying to remember what city it was, some city in Ohio. I'd have to go back and look. One of the big Ohio cities. He was a PPC. He actually kind of did it in the opposite direction. He was a PPC shooter, won the national championships multiple times. And the legend goes, new chief comes in, gets briefed on all his people, calls Heil out of the office and says, if you are the best shot in the entire police force, how the hell come you're not on the SWAT team? And Heil said, nobody ever asked me. She says, well, hell, I'm asking you. I think we should have the national champion on the SWAT team. And the next thing you know, Heil's on the SWAT team. At that time, the auto pistol still had not taken over. Service revolver was pretty much standard. And the guys on the SWAT team had all bought their own 38 Supers. And the story goes, Heil said, well, if you don't mind, I do all my shooting with a revolver, and I'm way more familiar with it. And guys would tease and say, oh, Mr. Target Shooter, old-fashioned. And the time comes, the SWAT team is in plain clothes doing a stakeout. That guy shows up and starts shooting, and the version of the story I was told, there was, you know, more 38 Super Brass on the street than you'd find AK Brass in Beirut. Nobody has hit the bad guy. And Heil, like 35 yards away, rolls his trigger four times, shoots the guy four times in the center of the chest, and the bad guy falls down and dies. And you see that often enough. You know, everybody says correlation is not causation. Okay, I'll buy that, but correlation is a goddamn good clue. And this is just something I've seen again and again. The guy's really accustomed to shooting under pressure. When the shit hit the fan, the pressure was the norm, and they performed in a stellar fashion.
So I think it's safe to say that you think the upsides outweigh the downsides to whatever complaints folks may have about the so-called impracticality of competition shooting.
Yeah. Well, there are certain things that are impractical. You'd think by now the bad guys might have figured out if they all carried a whistle and when shit hit the fan, blew their whistle and screamed ceasefire, all the cops would have reflexively emptied their guns. But you know what? That hasn't happened yet. One thing that used to drive me nuts, well, I actually got out of USPSA shooting. I'd run the first IPSC sectional in the country right after it started in the mid-70s. And I got out of it in the early, I want to say it was 1980 or so. I was in the Midwest, and I shot an IPSC match that had a stage called the Sidewinder, where you have to step out from behind cover into the open to engage multiple targets. Forgive my language there, but I was thinking, what the fuck am I doing? That's it. I'm so out of this shit. Eventually, I did get back in because I figured out, you know what? If I'm stupid enough that I can't tell the difference, I'm stupid enough that when people are shooting at me, I'm going to step outside of my cover to engage them, I'm probably too damn stupid to be carrying a gun to begin with. So, in essence, if you think you're not smart enough to tell the difference, maybe you aren't. Maybe you shouldn't shoot it. Maybe you should even reconsider whether you should carry a gun at all. But other than that, it's a piece of the puzzle. No, no one thing is the whole thing. You know, go to my school and you'll be a deadly gunfighter in 10 easy lessons. That's bullshit. But the competition side is a piece of the puzzle. Force on force has been a huge piece of the puzzle, so long as it's done right. The integration of combatives. Back in the 70s, I was writing in Law and Order magazine, look, we've got, you got this young kid in the academy. By the time he reaches his field training officer, the firearms guy has told him to do one thing against the guy with a knife. The hand-to-hand combat instructor has told him to do something else against it. Shit, it's only a knife. Only a pussy needs a gun against a knife. And the guy with the PR-24 baton instructor has said, no, 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 here's my magic PR-24 baton technique. And for the love of God, we've got to integrate this. It's force. It's going to go up and down the scale in microseconds. And the kid's got to be integrated. And today, thank God, we have seen it much more than we used to. It's not complete. But we have seen integrated use of force training. And that's why I love seeing the emphasis on integrated combatives that we see, for example, at Tom's seminar every year. So we've made great strides in that. Now, there was absolutely nobody doing that in the 50s, the 60s, the early 70s.